Hello, it is time to read from the Sioux City Journal for today, Saturday, January 30th, 2021. My name is John Reef, and I'll be bringing you the news today. Here's a look at what I'll be reading. We'll start with the weather and the mini editorial, then we'll move to the front page story, and then on into the inside pages for stories of local interest. At the 20-minute mark, we'll read the opinion page, any letters to the editor. At the 30-minute mark, we'll read the obituaries, then followed with sports feature stories as time allows, and wrapping up with Dear Abby. For today, weather-wise, cloudy with a rain or snow shower, a high of 36 degrees today, winds east-northeast at 8 to 16 miles an hour. Tonight, snow at times, 1 to 3 inches expected, going to get breezy too, winds out of the north-northwest at 10 to 20, and 28 degrees for the low. For Sunday, breezy in the morning, then mostly cloudy in the rest of the day, a high of 31 degrees, winds in that morning, north-northwest, 10 to 20 miles an hour again. A low of Sunday night of 15, and then on Monday, intervals of cloud and sun, and a high of 29 degrees for Monday, wind south-southeast at 6 to 12 miles an hour. Mostly clear skies Monday night, low of 19, mostly sunny on Tuesday, a high of 36 degrees. Tuesday night's low of 29, and mostly cloudy, could get some sleet on Wednesday night, and a high of 39 degrees for Wednesday. Take a look today at the mini editorial. This by Bill LePay of Sioux City, and it reads as follows. About 1 week into his presidency, and Biden, as of January 28th, has signed 33-plus executive orders, and this guy says he wants to unify the country. For context, Trump signed one. The rest of the changes that were made were voted on and passed by Congress. With Biden, it sounds more like, just do what I say and we'll get along. Instead of unity, it looks more like disinformation and deception. This by Bill LePay of Sioux City. Take a look at the front page story. Sioux City's Last Cobbler is the title. Mark Heft reflects on career repairing footwear and Western tack. This by Brett Hayworth, Dateline Sioux City. Mark Heft raced through a verbal list of all of the Siouxland cobblers he knew who have closed businesses over the last few decades, citing those in the nearby cities of Sheldon, Carroll, Sac City, Denison, Kingsley, and Takema, along with many more. Then Heft, the last known cobbler in Sioux City, and within about a 70-mile radius of the city, went through the list of those that had closed in the metro since his youth. Gone are cobblers who worked by the former St. Joseph Hospital, in the Riverside neighborhood, along 21st Street, in the downtown Yonkers building basement, and in South Sioux City. Speaking on a January afternoon, Heft said some days are rife with stops by customers who bring in boots and shoes for repairs, while other days have fewer patrons. He gets many thank yous from the customers for offering a service that doesn't exist along large swaths of the map. I hear that pretty much every day, Heft said, in a back workroom filled with assorted hammers, awls, jerk needles, and heavy wax thread. One such appreciative customer was Damon Picot of Winnebago, Nebraska, who wore a pair of boots he wanted Heft to consider repairing. Lifting a leg to show the boot degradation, Picot said Heft had very ably previously repaired other boots for him. He is very professional. It stands up to the elements. He is a great leadersmith, Picot said. With that comment, Picot referenced the broader nature of Heft's 4T tack and boot shop in Transit Plaza. The business also offers repairs to leather saddles, bridles, and the like. The workload is always challenging, as the footwear is lined up on shelving for the next one he'll pull off to repair back in the workroom. More to the middle of the store, a bevy of saddles fills up one section. I am almost always behind, Heff said, so it is frequent for people to get their footwear back a few weeks later, which they seem to willingly accept. There is a need to be skilled with fingers and know how to improvise when the case calls for it. Heft pondered what makes a good cobbler, then offered, you have to pay attention. He added that a lot of people drop off a product, saying it likely needs a basic stitching. There's no such thing as a simple stitch. It always leads to something else, Heft said knowingly. About 40% of the repairs Heft does are done by hand, with the rest with the assistance of some impressive-looking machines, with several coming from Germany. There is a Dorkop Adler machine, one called a heel wheel, and a sole stitching unit that dates to 1964. You can't get a new one. I've tried, Heft said. Heft grew up in the Greenville neighborhood of Sioux City riding horses, so he's had a lifetime of knowing their leather accoutrements. He got his first pair of boots when attending McKinley Elementary School, but didn't become a cobbler until decades into his life. While attending East High School in the mid-1970s, he began work at the Hinky Dinky grocery store. After some years of that, Heft worked for International Harvester, then became an over-the-road trucker for about 30 years, at which point, the wife and kids wanted me home. I was kind of talked into it. My cousin had the equipment. He was a farrier, Heft said, so we bought it. Heft thought he would only focus on saddles and bridles, but then saw he had the skills to become a cobbler. Today, he also makes leather pistol holsters and even cell phone holders. 4T Tack and Boot, which opened in 2005, is located next to other Transit Plaza stores that include Flowerland, Vac Shack, Mom's Thrift Shop, and Anytime Auctions. Heft works mornings and afternoon hours on Tuesday through Saturday and then takes 2 days off. Heft said the next closest cobblers are in Yankton, South Dakota, and Storm Lake, Iowa. Back in 2006, when he closed the cobbler's bench in downtown Sioux City after 38 years, Master Cobbler Dick Stevens said it was due to a throwaway society where shoes were no longer made well enough to warrant being repaired. Heft agreed some shoes and boots are made more cheaply today with less sturdy shoes and soles, so there is no point in repairing them. But for other boots and shoes, he is more than skilled to replace a heel or sole or to sew up the back portion by the heel. I don't like working on junk. I like working on quality, whether it is quality boots or quality saddles. I don't like giving up on things easily, Heft said. He said a lot of people don't know that in a good shoe, the heel and sole are separate pieces. People wear out heels first, and for boots, a good pair can get 2 heel repairs before the sole needs attention. For shoes or boots, if there's a need to address both the heel and sole, those tasks can be finished within 2.5 hours. Some of that might involve some time for glue to dry beyond what's done with Heft's dexterous fingers. Heft used to advertise in a variety of formats, but now sees there is sufficient word of mouth to direct customers to the business. He works about 45 to 50 hours a week, but allowed that he's less likely to work into evenings these days. Heft turns 63 in February and has allowed himself to think about how much longer he'll operate as a cobbler owning 4T Tack and Boot. He says he'll continue for at least a few more years, and if he closes up, that could mark the end of the cobbler era in Sioux City. There is nobody else around to do this, he said. In an inset picture on page A4, it shows Mark Heft using a leather patcher industrial sewing machine to repair a Doc Martens shoe at 4T Tack and Boot in Sioux City on Wednesday. On the front page, it shows another picture of Mark Heft sitting in his 4T Tack and Boot workshop on Wednesday in Transit Plaza. Heft, who repairs shoes, boots, saddles, and other leather equipment, is known as the last cobbler in Sioux City. Next story on the front page, in-person education option to be required. Governor Reynolds signed school bill, makes pitch for another. This by Aaron Murphy, the Dateline Des Moines. The ink was not yet dry on Governor Kim Reynolds' first K-12 education priority when she was already on to her next. Reynolds on Friday signed into law a requirement that K-12 schools offer to all students the option of 100% in-person learning, even if districts are not operating completely in-person during the COVID-19 pandemic. During a bill signing ceremony at the Iowa Capitol, Reynolds spoke about that bill, but also pivoted to making a push for her other major K-12 education priority this year, a sweeping proposal that creates taxpayer-funded private tuition assistance for students in struggling schools, expands the state's public charter school program, and eliminates diversity programs that do not allow students to open enroll out of the district to another public school. Elsewhere, Friday in western Iowa, a Republican state lawmaker said the governor's school choice proposal does not, in its current form, have sufficient support to pass the GOP-led Iowa House. There are not the votes in the House to pass that bill. There are not the votes in the House Republican caucus, at least now. Not even close, Representative Brent Segrist, Republican from Council Bluffs, an assistant majority leader and former House Speaker, said Friday during the Council Bluffs Area Chamber of Commerce's legislative Zoom event. There is a lot of opposition to that language because of what it would mean long-term for a system of vouchers in the state of Iowa. At the bill signing ceremony, Reynolds highlighted various K-12 education programs that have been created and investments that have been made during her tenure before making a direct pitch to the legislative proposal she calls her Students First Act. "This is just the beginning," Reynolds said while signing in the required 100% in-person learning option, which goes into effect February 15th. The pandemic has put a spotlight on K-12 education across the nation, and while I believe with all my heart that Iowa has the best education system in the country, we're not perfect. We can do better, and we should. Reynolds and supporters, chiefly fellow Republicans, say the legislation would provide more educational options for Iowa students and families, particularly in schools that are underperforming, according to metrics in a federal education program. Critics of the proposal, chiefly Democrats, and many public education advocates have expressed concern that it would weaken the state's public school system by creating more competition for state funding. "I have no desire to defund our schools or prevent their progress, but I will not turn a blind eye to opportunities for improvement where it's necessary. A strong public school system is imperative, and my education reform bill has the potential to raise the quality of all schools," Reynolds said Friday. "Every child deserves a quality education, regardless of income and no matter their zip code. And when a school is failing a child, parents should have the ability to change the course of their child's education for the better. We will always look to create opportunities for every single Iowan, including our youngest." The Republican-controlled Iowa Senate passed Reynolds' proposal this week. 3 Senate Republicans voted against it, and a 4th voted against it in committee, but in favor of its final passage there. In the GOP-controlled House, Speaker Pat Grassley, Republican from New Hartford, said the proposal will be given its consideration, but not immediately. The proposal likely will need the support of at least 51 of the 59 House Republicans, since it seems unlikely any Democrats will support the measure. All Senate Democrats voted against it. "During a pandemic, when our schools and teachers have been forced to do even more with less, we should be investing more resources in our public schools than ever before. From ever-increasing class sizes to rural consolidation, it's clear that we need to invest in the kids in our public schools, not take money away for vouchers," Iowa Democratic Party Chairman Ross Wilburn said in a statement. "Every child in Iowa should have the opportunity to go to a top-notch public school with all the tools they need to be successful. Iowa Democrats will continue to fight for world-class public schools for every child, no matter their zip code." On the front page, it shows an inset picture of Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds signing into law a measure that all public schools must offer children a 100% in-person option during the pandemic. Next story on the front page, Big Ox seeks to dismiss city suit. This is by Nick Heitrick, Dateline Omaha. Big Ox Energy is seeking dismissal of the City of South Sioux City's legal claims that the company misled it about the capabilities of its now-closed renewable fuel plant and breached its contract. The Wisconsin-based company also says the city's lawsuit was filed after the 2-year statute of limitations. The city sued Big Ox, Wells Fargo, and other lenders in December in Dakota County District Court, seeking a judge's order rescinding a tipping agreement the city signed with Big Ox and declaring that the city does not owe millions of dollars in unpaid monthly fees that lenders are now seeking. The city also wants Big Ox ordered to resume operations. Big Ox had the lawsuit moved to federal court on January 19th, and on Tuesday filed a motion in U.S. District Court in Omaha to dismiss the city's claims of negligent misrepresentation and breach of contract because the lawsuit did not include necessary facts on which to base the city's claims. The company says the city's claim that it misrepresented its abilities to develop the plant, which converted organic waste into methane and also pretreated the city's industrial waste and discharged it to Sioux City's regional wastewater treatment plant from September 2016 until its closure in 2019, contains no specific misrepresented facts or statements made by Big Ox or its representatives. Big Ox also says that the factual basis for the city's breach of contract claim started in 2017 when state and federal environmental regulators first cited the plant for violations. Because that factual basis began in 2017, Big Ox says the city's December filing was beyond the two-year window allowed under state law. The city has yet to file its response to Big Ox's motion to dismiss. Big Ox began operations at its plant in the city's Roth Industrial Park in September 2016 and was soon subject to odor complaints from neighbors. The city said Big Ox began failing to fulfill its promises to the city shortly thereafter when it stopped accepting certain wastewater in an attempt to reduce odors. Big Ox shut down the plant in April 2019 after Sioux City declined to renew the company's wastewater treatment permit because of non-payment of outstanding fees, fines, and other charges. In January 2020, Nebraska regulators revoked Big Ox's air and stormwater permits because of a continual failure to comply with state regulations. Because of that, the city said it should not be required to make the $225,000 monthly payments contained in a 2014 tipping agreement, which was an inducement for Wells Fargo Trust Company to provide financing for construction of the approximately $30 million plant. Wells Fargo has sued the city seeking more than $3.3 million in payments the city has not made since May of 2019. The city has denied Wells Fargo's claim for payment, saying it was not filed on time. The city also said it should not have to pay monthly payments since March 2019 when it placed Big Ox in default of the tipping agreement for failing to operate the wastewater treatment facility in accordance with the agreement. Big Ox faces 15 lawsuits in Dakota County filed by nearby residents who say toxic gases from the plant backed up into their homes through the city's sewer system and have caused health problems and property damage. The city of South Sioux City is also named in those suits. Big Ox also faces a federal lawsuit filed by a former plant neighbor who says the company is partially responsible for her husband's death and that odors and gases from the plant ruined their home. On the front page, it shows the Big Ox Energy plant in an April 19, 2019 photo at the Roth Industrial Park in South Sioux City. The now-closed renewable energy company has asked a judge to dismiss claims in a lawsuit filed by the city of South Sioux City. Next and last story on the front page, one-shot vaccine proves effective. The first one-shot COVID-19 vaccine provides good protection against the illness, Johnson & Johnson reported in a key study released Friday, offering the world a potentially important new tool as it races to stay ahead of the rapidly mutating virus. The pharmaceutical giant's preliminary findings suggest the single-dose option may not be as strong as Pfizer's or Moderna's two-dose formula and was markedly weaker against a worrisome mutated version of the virus in South Africa. But amid a rocky start to vaccinations worldwide, that may be an acceptable trade-off to get more people inoculated faster with an easier-to-handle shot that, unlike rival vaccines that must be kept frozen, can last months in the refrigerator. Frankly, simple is beautiful, said Dr. Matt Hepburn, the U.S. government's COVID-19 vaccine response leader. Johnson & Johnson plans to seek emergency use authorization in the U.S. within a week. It expects to supply 100 million doses to the U.S. by June and a billion doses globally by year's end, but declined to say how much could be ready if the Food and Drug Administration gives the green light. Defeating the scourge that has killed more than 2 million people worldwide will require vaccinating billions. The shots being rolled out in different countries so far all require two doses a few weeks apart for full protection. Nearly 23 million Americans have received a first dose of Pfizer or Moderna shots since vaccinations began last month, but fewer than 5 million have gotten their second dose. Also Friday, regulators cleared a third option, AstraZeneca's vaccine, for use throughout the European Union. The decision came amid criticism that the 27-nation bloc is not moving fast enough, as well as concern that there's not enough data to tell how well the vaccine works in older people. The European Medicines Agency's expert committee unanimously recommended the vaccine to be used in people 18 and over, although concerns had been raised this week that not enough data exists to prove it works in older people, and some countries indicated that they might not give it to the elderly. The shot is the third COVID-19 vaccine given the green light by the European Medicines Agency, after ones by Pfizer and Moderna. Johnson & Johnson studied its one-dose option in 44,000 people in the U.S., Latin America, and South Africa. Interim results found the shot 66% effective overall at preventing moderate to severe COVID-19 and much more protective, 85%, against the most serious symptoms. There were no serious side effects. Gambling on one dose was certainly worthwhile, Dr. Mathal Mammon, Global Research Chief for J&J's Janssen Pharmaceutical Unit, told the Associated Press. The vaccine worked better in the U.S., 72% effective against moderate to severe COVID-19, compared with 66% in Latin America and 57% in South Africa, where a more contagious mutant virus is spreading. The reduced protection against that mutation is, quoting here, really a wake-up call, end quote, said Dr. Anthony Fauci, the top U.S. infectious disease expert. The more the virus is allowed to spread, the more opportunities it has to mutate. Vaccine makers are looking into how to alter their shots if necessary. For now, the findings are an incentive, quoting here, to vaccinate as many people as we possibly can, Fauci stressed. Data is mixed on how well other vaccines being used around the world work, but the Pfizer and Moderna shots were 95% protective in large U.S. studies. It's not fair to compare studies done before the record surges of recent months and discovery of new mutants. They might not turn out the same today, cautioned Dr. Jesse Goodman of Georgetown University, a former FDA vaccine chief. The Johnson & Johnson protection is, quoting here, good enough to help attack a pandemic, end quote, Goodman said. Quoting again, the advantage of having more vaccine in a single shot could be significant. Meanwhile, Fauci said Friday he hopes to see some kids starting to get vaccinated for COVID-19 in the next few months. It's a needed step to securing widespread immunity to the virus. Vaccines are not yet approved for children, but testing already is underway for those as young as 12. If those trials are successful, Fauci said they would be followed by another round of testing down to those 9 years old. Quoting here, hopefully by the time we get to the late spring and early summer, we'll have children being able to be vaccinated, Fauci said at a White House coronavirus briefing. Fauci was looking ahead to a time vaccines will be plentiful. Even older adults are having difficulty getting shots at the moment. As of Thursday, only about 1.3% of Americans had been fully vaccinated with the required two doses of the currently available vaccines. Time now for the opinion page, and today we've got other voices as well as one letter to the editor. We'll start with other voices. This by the Cedar Rapids Gazette. In the front page picture, it shows a picture of the old Capitol on the University of Iowa campus in Iowa City, shown August 12, 2020. The title is Lawmakers Want to Micromanage Universities, and again by the Cedar Rapids Gazette. A bill that advanced past a subcommittee in the Iowa House would bar the state's public universities from spending money from grants, donations, and other non-state sources without approval by state lawmakers. It's the latest misguided effort by lawmakers to micromanage universities with dubious justifications. It doesn't take much imagination to think of scenarios where such a change would be disruptive and harmful. If the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics receive a grant to conduct pressing medical research, perhaps on a pandemic virus, why should it be required to embark on the cumbersome task of seeking legislative approval? Will donors be more reluctant to give gifts to the universities, knowing their donation could become a political football at the State House? Will legislators approve a grant for agricultural studies at Iowa State, but turn down a grant for cultural studies at the University of Iowa? The troubling scenarios of injecting politicians into these decisions are countless. This is the same legislature that has underfunded Iowa's universities for years, forcing them to seek external sources of dollars. Now lawmakers are worried about how those dollars are being spent. Beyond the state budget, lawmakers already have plenty of input into university governance. The Board of Regents, which oversees the state's three universities, is appointed by the governor, and its members are confirmed by the Iowa Senate. Legislators routinely call university presidents and other officials to testify before legislative committees. So oversight is adequate, and lawmakers concerned with spending decisions have multiple channels for airing those concerns and getting answers. Placing legislators in a position to give a thumbs up or down to myriads decisions on how the universities spend grants and other outside dollars would be a big mistake. Lawmakers should instead concentrate on how to make our universities better, starting with a more robust state investment. Again, that from the Cedar Rapids Gazette and other voices. Next is a letter to the editor from Jacob Wanderscheid, executive director of the Food Bank of Siouxland. It's titled, Food Bank of Siouxland Offers Thanks for Donations. Thank you for your continued support of the Food Bank of Siouxland and its partner, Hunger Fighting Organizations, on behalf of the staff and board of directors. As the events of the pandemic unfolded in March, individuals and organizations stepped up to ensure households had meals, aiding those experiencing hunger through Siouxland. This aid ranged from generous donors who had provided truckloads of frozen protein to groups of persons who helped food pantries who handed out product in drive-by style distributions to financial contributions towards purchasing food. Every action made an impact. As many households spent Thanksgiving apart, this increased the amount of food this time of year. In 2020, the Siouxland community distributed over 3.5 million pounds of food to those experiencing food insecurity. This is up nearly a million pounds from 2019. Each extra pound of food made a family's experience better, and yet Siouxlanders will still need assistance in 2021. Again, thank you for your support of the Food Bank of Siouxland. Great letter from Jacob Wanderscheid, the executive director of the Food Bank of Siouxland, on the opinion page. Okay, this is not on the opinion page, but it is under page A2 under Local Voices. It's a letter from Casey Vaughn, executive director of Keep Fremont Beautiful, and it is titled KFB Awarded Funding from NDEE. Keep Fremont Beautiful is pleased to announce that the Nebraska Department of Environment and Energy has awarded KFB with funding from the Litter Reduction and Recycling and Waste Reduction and Recycling Incentive Grant Programs for the year of 2021. KFB was awarded $70,785 in grant funding from the Litter Reduction and Recycling Grant Program to assist in supporting the overall operations at Keep Fremont Beautiful, including our public education program. The KFB Public Education Program provides continuous environmental education on important topics such as litter prevention, waste reduction, proper disposal, recycling, and community beautification to youth, teens, and adults throughout the city of Fremont and surrounding areas. Educational information is taught through a variety of avenues, including school and community presentations and workshops, public service announcement campaigns, print material distribution, social media platforms, and at local events. KFB was also awarded $30,414 in grant funding from the Waste Reduction and Recycling Incentive Grant Program. This grant award provides the funding that is needed to host the annual Household Hazardous Waste Collection event. The vast majority of this award covers the expense of contracting an environmental services agency to properly store and dispose of the hazardous material that is collected. The 2021 HHW collection will take place on Saturday, October 9th at Christensen Field. The exact time of this event is yet to be determined. You may contact the KFB office with questions regarding what materials will be accepted. Keep Fremont Beautiful is beyond grateful to receive this funding from the NDEE for 2021. Although these grant awards cover a large portion of the financial support needed for annual operations, as part of the grant agreements, KFB is required to provide cash and in-kind matches for grant reimbursements. The City of Fremont and Dodge County grant a KFB with funding to assist with the required cash match. However, we also rely on membership donations from the KFB Partners Association to meet our cash match obligation. By joining the Partners Association, you are ensuring the success of our educational program, as well as local recycling and hazardous waste disposal events. Everyone has a role to play in taking care of our environment. It just takes one person, one school, one business, or one organization to inspire others. With your support, we can keep our community clean, green, and beautiful for future generations. To join the 2021 KFB Partners Association, you may visit our website at keepvermontbeautiful.org to select your desired partnership level and submit your membership donation. You may also print and mail your membership form and donation to the KFB office at 529 North Main Street, Suite 4, Fremont, Nebraska, 68025. Please feel free to contact the KFB at 402-941-6122 or keepfremontbeautiful@gmail.com with questions. Wishing you all a happy and healthy 2021. Again, that letter's from Casey Vaughn, Executive Director of Keep Fremont Beautiful. Okay, we have obituaries on two separate pages today, so we'll get started with those. The first one from Cologne, Nebraska, Vinette J. Tenopier, that's T-E-N-O-P-I-R, Vinette J. Tenopier, 86 years old, of Cologne, Nebraska, passed away Friday, January 29th in Omaha. She was born on March 8th, 1934 in Omaha to Vincent and Claire Hornig Southwick. She was raised in Omaha and graduated from Mercy High School. She married Adolph Tenopier on August 9th, 1958 in Omaha. They moved to Malmo, Nebraska, and then to Cedar Bluffs, where they were farming. She was a member of St. Mary's Catholic Church and the Cedar Bluffs American Legion Auxiliary Post number 158. Okay, it's time now for the obituaries, starting with Sioux City. Ruth M. Phillips, 87 years old, having been born on January 20th, 1934, of Sioux City, went to be with her Heavenly Father on Sunday, January 24th. A celebration of life will be planned at a later date. Cards may be sent to Christy Smith Funeral Homes, 1801 Morningside Avenue, Sioux City, to be forwarded to her family. From Sioux Center, Joan Mow, M-O-U-W, 91 years old, of Sioux Center, passed away Tuesday, January 26th at Royal Meadows Care Center in Sioux Center. Service will take place at 3 p.m. Sunday at Memorial Funeral Home in Sioux Center with Reverend Jerry Veerman officiating. Burial will be in Memory Garden Cemetery in Sioux Center. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the memorial service on Sunday at Memorial Funeral Home in Sioux Center. Mask and social distancing will be used. Joan Eleanor Vreeman was born to Hein and Johanna Vreeman on January 10th, 1930, near Hull, Iowa. Joan had one brother, Gary, who with his wife Nikki had 10 children who Joan enjoyed in her role as their aunt. Joan attended a country school in the Hull area, then attended Western Christian High School in Hull, graduating in 1947. She studied 1 year at Northwestern College in Orange City, then attended Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan, where she graduated with a bachelor's degree in education in 1951. On June 6, 1952, she married William Mao in Sioux Center. They shared 62 years in marriage until Bill passed on in 2015. Bill and Joan enjoyed entertaining and cooking together, providing generous hospitality to many. Bill served as the Sioux Center mayor for 14 years. As mayor's wife, their home was open for entertaining city guests and visitors such as the Dutch ambassador and his wife. Bill and Joan also enjoyed the lakes area and spent many summers there together. Even after Bill was gone, Joan continued frequent trips to her favorite restaurant at the lakes as long as she was able. Joan believed in living a life of purpose. She exhibited a deep love and purpose for children through their gift of teaching. Joan was an educator for 39 years. Her first position in 1951 was as an English teacher at Western Christian High School, followed by a year in a rural K-6 school near Sioux Center. Then she began teaching in Sioux Center with 2 years in the junior high school. In the rest of her career, she was in the K-6 grades teaching in special education classes and later helped develop the resource room for students with learning disabilities. In 1971, she attended the University of South Dakota in Vermilion and earned her master's degree in supervision of special education. From 1975 to 1985, she taught summer and evening classes in learning disorders at Dort College in Sioux Center and at Northwestern College in Orange City. In 1975, Joan was awarded a Certificate of Recognition for Meritorious Service to Exceptional Children for Outstanding Service in the Field of Special Education. She was recognized as an outstanding teacher in 1985 and 86 by receiving the Iowa State Teacher of the Year honors. She received this honor again in 1991 by the State of Iowa Board of Recognition. She retired from teaching in May of 1991. Joan devoted her life to many purposes in addition to her long teaching career. She was a member of Central Reformed Church, where she was active and volunteered in many ways through the years. She was active in the local American Legion Auxiliary Chapter and was a member and officer in a variety of professional groups. In June of 1980, she was selected as Outstanding Individual of the Year 1980 by the Sioux County Association of Retarded Citizens and statewide recognition by Iowa ARC as the guiding force for the establishment of the Sioux City ARC organization to help the parents of mentally disabled children as well as the disabled themselves. Joan received the Individual Volunteer Award from the City of Sioux Center in 1994. Joan was one of the founders of the local PALS program, and she served on the PALS board for many years. She received a number of other volunteer awards over the years. Upon presenting one of her awards, a speaker was noted to declare, "Her efforts have been devoted to the total welfare of the student, educationally, vocationally, and spiritually. Her life has been an example of kindness to her fellow man. She has lived with purpose and will be fondly remembered by the many she taught." From Sioux City, Lois A. Chiquette, 96 years old, passed away Wednesday, January 27th. Services will be February 2nd, 11 a.m., Immaculate Conception Catholic Church. Burial will be at Memorial Park Cemetery. Visitation will be February 1st from 4 to 7 p.m. Arrangements are being handled by Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel. Live stream available at the church's website. From Winnebago, Nebraska, Vern F. Mayberry, 77 years old, passed away Sunday, January 24th. Graveside service will be May 15th at 11 a.m. at Omaha Valley Cemetery in Homer with military honors. Arrangements with Munderloh Smith Funeral Home in Pender. From Cherokee, Rebecca L. Becky Heppner, H-O-E-P-P-N-E-R, 60 years old. Rebecca Becky Heppner died Thursday, January 28th. Services will be February 4th at 11 a.m. at Boothby Funeral Home in Cherokee. Burial will be at Oak Hill Cemetery in Cherokee. Visitation will be February 3rd from 4 to 7 p.m. and resume 1 hour prior to service time at the funeral home. Masks and social distancing required. Live stream also available on the funeral home's website. And the final one for today, Viola M. Leinart, L-E-I-N-A-R-T. Viola Leinart, 90 years old, died Thursday, January 28th. Arrangements are pending with Palin Funeral Services in Oakland, Nebraska. All right, moving now to sports on Section C. And the top picture is Eagles crush Panthers in South Dakota boys basketball. Paul Bruns scores 44 points in loss, this Dateline North Sioux City, by Barry Poe for the Journal. A highly anticipated matchup of number one versus number three turned into a runaway on Thursday night. Sioux Falls Christian put on a virtual clinic from start to finish, dominating Dakota Valley 92-72. The Eagles went into the Dakota 12 game ranked third in the South Dakota Sports Writers Association High School Boys poll, while host and previously unbeaten Dakota Valley was number one. Chances are the Eagles will leapfrog the Panthers in the next set of rankings. "They played great, and they've done that to us the last several years," Dakota Valley coach Jason Kleiss said. "We have a hard time stopping them. They get that ball in the paint, kick it out, and they can all shoot. It's tough to game plan against them because they're very balanced. At the end of the day, you can sum up everything by saying they executed perfectly. They guarded us real well and frustrated us where I didn't feel like we did anything together offensively like we wanted to. That's a credit to them." Paul Bruns did his best to keep the Panthers, now 10-1, in the game with a 44-point explosion, but the All-Stater and University of North Dakota recruit, along with younger brother Isaac, who scored 12 points, were basically the only offense Dakota Valley could muster. Conversely, Sioux Falls Christian, 11-2, had all five starters in double figures. The Chargers tallied 20 points or more in all four quarters and rarely missed a shot. For the game, Sioux Falls Christian shot a sizzling 36 of 56, or 64%. The Chargers led the entire game but began pulling away in the second quarter, outscoring DV 27-12. Bruns drained a three-pointer in the closing seconds of the first quarter, pulling to within 21-19. However, by halftime, the lead had ballooned into 47-31, and the Chargers tacked on a 25-point third quarter, taking an insurmountable 72-48 cushion. Noah Van Donkersgoed, a 6'5 senior, paced Sioux Falls Christian with 24 points. The silky smooth forward made 11 of 15 shots. Tyler Prenz was next in line with 22 points, 9 for 11, while Xavier Van Beek added 19 points, and Brooks Nelson posted a double-double with 12 points and 10 rebounds. The fifth starter in double digits was Jaden Whitty with 10 points. "I told the guys, if this doesn't tick you off a little bit, something's wrong with you," Clay said. "But we have to keep our heads up. It's going to make us better. I think we're a better team than we showed tonight." Sioux Falls Christian lost to Class AA Sioux Falls O'Gorman 82-71 on December 19th and 66-53 at No. 2 Vermilion on January 21st. Dakota Valley still has a February 9th road game at Vermilion, which stays unbeaten at 12-0, with a 68-66 win over Del Rapids Thursday. Dakota Valley started a string of five consecutive road games Friday at Hartington, Nebraska, Cedar Catholic. It shows inset pictures on one on page A4 of Dakota Valley's Randy Rosenquist dribbling to the basket as Sioux Falls Christian's Jaden Whitty defends him during Thursday night's game in North Sioux City. And on the front page of the sports section, it shows Dakota Valley's Paul Bruns dribbling to the basket past Sioux Falls Christian's Noah Van Donkersgoed during Thursday's top three matchup in North Sioux City. Next story about some Nebraska girls wrestling. It's titled Setting the Line. Cardinals ranked number one in NSWCA tourney. This by Nick Rubeck in Dateline, South Sioux City. "You can hear how much Artie Zamora means it when she says it. There's a confidence in the pronunciation, a grind-your-back-teeth accent in every syllable. Dominate, the South Sioux City senior says again and again. Dominating is a big thing for us and a big thing for me. I want to make them hurt, make them work for every point. Zamora is part of a wrestling evolution that it continues in the state of Nebraska. She may even be the poster child. She just can't get enough of it. The weekend wrestlers, just like Zamora, will take center stage at the girls' state tournament in New York. The second-year event began Friday and is again being put on by the Nebraska Scholastic Wrestling Coaches Association because girls' wrestling is newly classified by the NSAA as an emerging sport without an official state championship. Emphasis on yet. This isn't going away in a year or two, South Sioux City coach Evan Bonnet said. Participation numbers have nearly doubled over the past year from 140 in 2020 to 278 this season, according to Ron Higdon, the NSAA assistant director in charge of wrestling. Bonet has seen a similar spike in interest. 2 years ago, South Sioux City was a team of two. That number grew to eight last season, the same two girls and six of their friends, and was as high as 14 at times this year. Four have a year of experience, the rest are wrestling for the first time. Zamora knows all about being a newcomer and not just to the Cardinals program. I didn't even know where the wrestling room was in the high school, she said. I had never watched it. Well, other than WWE. It's been a learning curve for everyone. Bonet, who also coaches the South Sioux City boys, credits assistants Jeff Wood and Jake Rinkin with keeping things straight. They learned early on that coaching girls wrestling is different from what they knew about coaching boys, but the payoff has been worth it. Zamora remembers her turning point, a match at a mid-season tournament that she led by 8 points before being pinned. It was at that moment, as odd as it may sound, that Zamora started feeling like she belonged. A state title at the inaugural girls state tournament came shortly after. The look of joy on her face in the hug, Bonet said about her celebration. It made me feel like this is real. This is happening. That event, he said, was the first time they really had the spotlight to themselves. You could see they felt important, Bonet said, and Zamora got the rock star treatment. Girls would come up to me at school and say that I inspire them, Zamora said, and that's inspiring to me. I'm breaking the norm. Wrestling may open doors for her, too. Zamora said she's received an offer to wrestle in college and is weighing those options. The fact that those are possibilities are something that has left her feeling very grateful. The girls in the future will have the opportunities, Zamora said. We're aspiring to be more than just girl wrestlers. South Sioux City is ranked number one by both the NSWCA and in New Wrestle heading to state. Zamora, 14-0, is one of three Cardinals ranked at the top of their weight classes by one of the two services, joined by younger sister Jackie at 154 pounds and sophomore Yohali Quinones, a unanimous number one at 142. The seven ranked wrestlers are tied with defending state champion West Point Beamer and Schuyler for most in the state. A team title, Zamora said, would be the ultimate cherry on top. South Sioux City finished fourth in 2020. Last year, we were just building the program, Zamora said. It feels more like wrestling this season. Now we want to dominate. There's that word again. It has two inset pictures on the front page. One shows the South Sioux City girls wrestling team chanting together after a practice at South Sioux City High School in South Sioux City, Nebraska on Thursday. The other inset picture shows Adriana Zamora listening to coaching while grappling with Yohali Quinones during a South Sioux City girls wrestling practice on Thursday at South Sioux City High School in South Sioux City. Now it shows an updated article on page C2. Cardinals sit in first place. The South Sioux City girls wrestling team holds the day one lead with 39.5 points Friday at the NSWCA girls state tournament at York High School. The Cardinals have a 7.5 point lead over Schuyler and a 9.5 point lead on West Point Beamer. The Cardinals have a slew of wrestlers competing in the semifinals starting on Saturday. Gina Gonzalez advanced to the quarterfinals at 103 pounds, and her next match will be against Skylar's Hazley Salgado. At 124, Selena Zamora received a bye in the first round and won by technical fall over Nebraska City's Lexi Southard at 16-1. Yohali Quinones, the Cardinals' 142-pounder, also received a first-round bye, then pinned Rita Ceballos of Johnson County Central in 2 minutes 57 seconds. South Sioux 154-pounder Jacqueline Zamora won by a fall over Alyssa Candies of West Point Beamer in 40 seconds in the second round after having a bye in the first round. Adriana Zamora needed 32 seconds to pin Fremont's Tristan Hansen in the first round at 170 pounds. Melissa De La Torre, 190, won by forfeit, while 140-pounder Marcella Limon received a first-round bye. Looking at some girls basketball, Mustangs beat South Central Calhoun. The Newell Fonda High School girls basketball team started out on a 21-4 run Friday night en route to beating South Central Calhoun 87-43. The Mustangs, who are 15-1, followed that up by scoring 37 points in the second quarter. Ella Larson led Newell Fonda with 17 points, and she made three 3-pointers. Macy Seavers scored 16, Bailey Seavers added 14. Maggie Walker also hit a 3-pointer and scored 12 points. Siouxland Christian downed River Valley 56-53. Cassie Jones scored a game-high 21 points to lead the Eagles to a Siouxland Conference girls basketball win in Correctionville on Friday. Cherokee downs Western Christian 76-43. Grace Anderson scored a game-high 14 points on Friday in that win. Jimmy Nichols scored 13. Molly Pitts had 10. Claire Bleeker led the Wolfpack with 10 points. Central Lion over Okoboji 70-26. The Lions' lone senior Hayden Heinzman scored 22 points on the team's senior night as she led her team to a Siouxland Conference girls basketball game in Rock Rapids on Friday. In Thursday night action, East 64, North 22, East School girls basketball team led the North Stars to 2 points in the second half on Thursday. The Black Raiders won 64-22. The Stars did not make a field goal in the third or fourth quarter. Kea Downs led the Black Raiders to 14.7 in each half. Sioux Falls Christian over Dakota Valley 65-63. Sioux Falls Christian spoiled Rachel Rosenquist's senior night on Thursday night. Her sister, junior Riley Rosenquist, scored a team-high 21 points on 5 made shots. She was also 11 for 17 from the free throw line. Riley Rosenquist also brought down 13 rebounds. Grace Bass and Georgia Vandahol each scored 12 points. Bass made 2 threes. Bass also made 3 offensive rebounds. Bishop Heland over West 51-30. The Crusaders jumped out to a 17-5 lead in the first half Thursday to beat the Wolverines. Tri-Valley 46, Elk Point Jefferson 43. Tri-Valley outscored the Huskies 16-8 in the third quarter. Both teams shot 35% from the floor. Tri-Valley was 13 for 20 from the free throw line. Denison Schleswig over Harlan 61-57. The Monarchs outscored Harlan 20-10 in the third quarter on Thursday. Paige Anderson led the Monarchs with 16 points. Hannah Neiman chipped in with 13 points and Ellie Magnuson with 11. In boys basketball, Kingsley Pearson over Woodbury Central, 64-56. Jackson Howell had 8 shots on Thursday to lead the Panthers with 21 points. Connor Bielner chipped in with 18 points. Malachi Christofferson made 2 threes and 5 free throws with 13 points. Sealine Christian over River Valley, 47-46. Cameron Pearson led the Eagles with 20 points in Thursday's win. Dalton DuBois scored 14 points. River Valley's top two scorers were Garrett Trapp with 19 and Trevor Town with 12. Sioux Central over Southeast Valley, 53-41. And Denison Schleswig over Harlan, 53-52 in boys basketball. All right, it's time for Dear Abby. The first letter today is from Puzzled About Helping. It's titled, Overwhelmed New Parents Struggle to Eat Healthy Food. Dear Abby, I have a close friend who recently had a baby with serious health problems. Unfortunately, we live on opposite sides of the country and I can't afford to fly out there. I want to help, but short of calls and texts to let her know I'm thinking of her, I'm out of ideas. She's mentioned several times that with all the work of being a new parent plus the extra work involved with a child with special needs, she often doesn't have time to prepare healthy meals and reverts to junk food that she can grab easily. Ordinarily, I'd bring over a few meals to help her out, but that's impossible to do when she's so far away. Restaurant gift cards would be an option, but unfortunately she and her husband don't have the time to go to one. I'm hoping you might have other ideas on how I can help out from afar, signed Puzzled About Helping. Dear Puzzled, go online and research food delivery services in the city or town where your friend lives. Some businesses deliver prepared meals on a weekly basis. Other companies ship boxes of wonderful fruits every month. But before doing anything, ask your overwhelmed friend what she and her husband might think be helpful rather than try to second guess. Next story is from well-mannered, next letter, excuse me, is from well-mannered lady in the Midwest, or in the West. It's, says, Dear Abby, I'd like to know if there's a nice way of asking my niece and her boyfriend who are in their mid to late 20s not to bring their phones to the dinner table. I have spent days preparing for and cooking holiday meals. The evening was less than enjoyable for me because they were only partly there and spent most of their time texting and presumably on Facebook. It's awkward to ask an adult to practice good manners. Any words of wisdom will be much appreciated, signed well-mannered lady in the West. Dear lady, explain to your niece that you spend a lot of time, money, and effort on presenting these meals and that you were hurt and offended at their apparent lack of appreciation. It's the truth. Do not preoccupy yourself with trying to be nice, or you will weaken the message. Some families solve this problem by insisting their guests place their cell phones in a basket before dinner and reclaim them as they depart. Just a thought. Last letter for today is from Shocked in Hawaii. Dear Abby, my friend from church casually mentioned that he and his wife recently helped themselves to several buckets of sand from a national park. I'm beside myself trying to understand how they can justify pillaging a natural resource so they can pretend they are at the beach. It's beyond selfish and just plain wrong. What can I say to convince them to return it? Can you help me navigate this conversation while still maintaining the friendship? Signed, Shocked in Hawaii. Dear Shocked, start by pointing out to your friends that there are serious penalties for doing what he and his wife did. I ran your letter by my former personal assistant, Winnie, who lives in Hawaii. She informed me that, according to the Department of Land and Natural Resources, stealing sand from the beaches is not only against the law, but also punishable with fines of upwards of $100,000. That is some expensive sand. Okay, one last look at the weather for today. Looks like cloudy skies, a rain or snow shower this evening, a high of 36 today, winds east-northeast at 8 to 16 miles per hour. Tonight, snow at times, 1 to 3 inches possible, going to be breezy late tonight with north-northwest winds at 10 to 20 miles an hour, a low tonight 28, breezy in the morning on Sunday, then mostly cloudy skies and a high of 31 degrees, winds in the morning at north-northwest 10 to 20 again. Mostly clear Sunday night, a low of 15, and intervals of clouds and sun on Monday, a high of 29 degrees, a low on Monday night of 19, and mostly sunny on Tuesday, Tuesday's high of 36 degrees, Tuesday night, mostly clear, low of 29, and mostly cloudy on Wednesday, sleet at night, and a high of 39 degrees for Wednesday. And that does it for reading the Sioux City Journal for today, Saturday, January 30th, 2021. For the last hour, the stories have been selected and read by me, John Reef. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print handicapped. If you have any questions, you can call toll-free at 877-404-4747. We thank you for listening to IRIS, your radio reading service.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate. A decade ago, there were typically 20 earthquakes a year that were large enough to feel in the central and eastern U.S. But in 2015, there were over 1,000 of them. Why? It's mostly because we're pumping more water into the ground. The boom in U.S. oil and gas production over the last decade has brought many more oil wells, which also produce water. Most is naturally occurring in the formation, and some was injected by operators to allow or improve the recovery of oil and gas. In both cases, the water will likely have picked up salt and other minerals from the rock, making it many times saltier than seawater. Operators may re-inject this water to continue to liberate oil and gas. But more often, there's too much to handle. So it's trucked or piped to disposal wells, where it's pumped down into deep saltwater reservoirs. Adding large volumes of wastewater increases the pressure in these rock formations, which can allow natural faults to slip more easily than they normally would, causing earthquakes. To address these quakes, regulators and the petroleum industry are monitoring disposal wells and shutting down those that could cause damaging seismic activity. And they now think that managing wastewater injection more carefully should help. There's still more work to be done, and university research centers, like the Bureau of Economic Geology, are conducting major studies with the aim of minimizing the risk of earthquakes while maintaining the benefits of domestic energy production. For EarthDate, I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.